Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with producer Jason DeFilippo. On the Jordan Harbinger Show, we decode the stories, secrets, and skills of the world's most brilliant and interesting people and turn their wisdom into practical advice that you can use to impact your own life and those around you. Darren Prince, the Prince of Cards, is one of the most successful sports agents with an absolutely insane origin story. This is a guy who was addicted to opiates for 24 years, starting at age 14. 14! He was making multiple six figures by the time he was old enough to drive and repping Magic Johnson, Smokin' Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, Pam Anderson, Charlie Sheen, Chevy Chase, Evel Knievel, Hulk Hogan, and others even in his 20s. Today, we'll hear how he held his empire together while his own life was falling apart, and some of the lessons, many of which are quite humbling, during his tenure as an agent and his sobriety, now 11 years strong and counting. I really clicked with Darren, and I thought this was not only a great story, but there were a lot of teachable moments as well. I met Darren through my network, as I am wont to do, and I'm teaching you how to network for personal and professional reasons, all for free in 6-minute networking. It takes 5 to 6 minutes a day, hence the name. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where you can find that. And by the way, most of the guests on the show actually subscribe to the course and the newsletter. So come join us and you'll be in great company. Here's Darren Prince. I read your book a long time ago and Jen was like, hey, there's this guy who's an agent. You should check him out. And I was like, oh, I already have this book. I was like, oh, interesting. Sports agent, like probably a lawyer. No.
Complete opposite.
And that's interesting for me because I went to law school and a lot of my friends are like, oh, I'm going to be a sports agent. I'm going to be a sports agent. You know, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to be a sports agent. And so I figured, oh, this guy's probably like, I could have just done what this guy did because he's probably a lawyer too. Not quite.
So you like the story about my dad fly fishing in Alaska?
Yeah.
I got that. I really want to be an agent, but I'm not a lawyer. May rest in peace. He looked at me. I remember like, yes, she goes, lawyer. You got the most amazing relationships in the world. Any lawyer would kill to have access to go to Muhammad Ali's house in Berrien Springs, Michigan, and go to Magic's house in Beverly Park and call up Joe Montana or, you know, Hulk Hogan. And it's all about who you know, Darren, and like not what you know.
It almost seems like you fell into some of this stuff. In the book, I'm sure it's condensed, but it's like dot, dot, dot. Oh, I'm running into Magic Johnson. And then I called Pamela Anderson. It's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Who are you calling? How do you even start these relationships?
It started from the baseball card business that eventually evolved into sports and celebrity memorabilia. That was very, very unorthodox.
On the show, I'm a big fan of using people's past or even current adversity as a competitive advantage or a superpower. And what I think is interesting is your clients are, among others, Dennis Rodman, Hulk Hogan, Charlie Sheen. It's a little bit like looking at a TMZ roster of people that may or may not have had some other issues in the past, you know?
Right.
Do you think you have an ability to relate to some of your clients better, like Dennis Rodman, maybe because of your past struggle with sobriety?
I mean, I think so. I also fully believe that America in general loves a good comeback story. I think all those guys have come back tremendously. Dennis, I always say, is a rebound king in life. You know, you can never count him out. Everybody's had something. Nobody's off the table. Even Magic Johnson had his issues years ago, obviously, and with the HIV announcement. And I mean, what he's done, what he does to give back to the community and to businesses and all over the world, nobody's done it like Magic Johnson has.
You started as a special ed kid from New Jersey?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's not the usual path to becoming one of the most successful sports agents. I assume at that age, you yourself might have even written yourself off as
absolutely
somebody.
You know, you listen to teachers. They tell you what you can and can't do and you start believing it.
Yeah.
My intro to business teacher, Elliot Lovey was his name. And I had a class with him and he wanted everybody to go home and create a business. And I remember being 13 years old and having this imagination that I was kind of this awkward, I don't want to say geeky, but felt like an outcast. I had this big baseball card collection that I amassed and that became my business. Eventually, I turned it into a real business and gave me a little bit of self-confidence.
So you weren't planning to turn it into a business. It was an assignment from your teacher?
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. Did he ever know that you were crushing?
To this day, I went back and I spoke at my high school 3 months ago when we still talk about
He's still there?
He's still there.
How old is he?
He's a legendary tennis teacher, tennis coach. He's won several state championships and yeah, he's probably in his early 70s now.
Wow.
And he knew that something was different about me and something was special because he would tell me to stay after class that I'm going to spend a little bit extra time with you. He saw the way my brain functioned and the way my brain worked, the same way my father did. And he pulled that out of me. He knew that 90% of what all the kids were doing wasn't good for Darren Prince. but I had this little 10% that none of them had.
It's funny that he spotted that, because I think public schools actually not set up at all to reward people who are entrepreneurial thinkers. My teachers do the same thing. They were like, oh, your son doesn't listen. He can't color inside the lines. That was literally a critique I would get. And I'm still coloring outside the lines. This is not a real job that I have here. This is a fake, made-up sham that somehow caught fire.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lightning in a bottle.
Right.
What happened to both of us.
Yeah.
It keeps happening.
Yeah. But it screws you up, right? Because you have this imposter syndrome, which there was no name for that back then.
Right.
It was just, you're right. You shouldn't be here. Right? Like, that was like, if you feel that way, you probably shouldn't be in the room.
Absolutely.
And I know you suffered from that a lot, especially when you were starting to meet Muhammad Ali and Smoking Joe, and you're just sitting there. What's going through your head when you're with these guys?
I only knew how to do it one way. I knew from the business side and the networking side and the entrepreneurial side, I knew what I was doing, but I felt so uncomfortable inside. I was always looking for that outside fix that was the inside job. And the only way I can do it was, honestly, I had to be high on opiates for years. It was Oxycontin, Vicodins, Percocets were my best friends, and nobody knew about it but me. And I like to build a very successful agency through that. But like I tell kids today when I speak, I would have gone back in a time machine in a second to trade that feeling of not wanting to wake up in the morning.
Really? You must have got pretty dark. And I want to rewind it a little bit, because how do you even think to get started on opiates? I mean, you started younger than literally anybody probably that you've met.
14 years old, I was in sleepaway camp. I told a counselor I had horrible stomach pains. This nurse, her name is Greta, she gave me this green liquid. And I took a shot. It tasted horrible. As I'm walking across the softball field, all those inadequacies and feelings we just talked about, of less than, not being a part of, not feeling as equal, went away like that.
Wow.
In those 5-10 seconds, my life changed forever. I wanted more of it. I now felt just as good, just as smart, just as popular, just as cool, just as funny. I got back to the bunk. The guys are laughing with me. I got the courage to go to the bunk next door for the first time in my life. I was flirting with girls at 14 years old, fearless. And I went to bed thinking nothing of it. The next day, I woke up, did all my activities that you do in summer camp. And that next night, I'm looking up at the sky thinking, that feeling was amazing last night, but there was no stomach pain. I looked at the counter. I heeled over. I said, man, my stomach is killing me. We got to go back. Did it for 3 straight weeks, that magic green liquid, until I found that it was liquid Demerol.
Demerol for a 14-year-old kid. I mean, wow. Any license you may or may not have had should be revoked, I would imagine, at that time. As a nurse, is it not insanely irresponsible? Hey, Darren has a stomach ache for 2 weeks in a row. Maybe he should see a doctor. Nobody thought about that.
Back then, I guess not. I mean, I know there was points where she was kind of telling me, you know, maybe you should get some x-rays, maybe you get some ultrasounds done. And I was like, no, it helps. I go to sleep every time I take it. And it was my parents that came up visitation day to meet with her because they heard about it. My mom obviously lost her crap, you know, when she found out, said the same thing. Why would you not call me? But here's the thing, and as an advocate, I don't blame the nurse, because it still would have happened. 6 months later, I was at a dentist appointment getting my wisdom teeth removed. And I lied to my mom after the 8 Vicodins were gone. I went downstairs holding my cheek. I said, Mom, I don't know what's going on. I got to go back to the dentist.
That's an argument for addict behavior being genetic or inborn or something like that, right?
I know doctors will tell you that. I don't believe in genetics. For me, I believe I never spoke up about feeling less than. I believe that it was a personality dysfunction, that because I didn't have the courage and I couldn't be real enough with my teachers and my friends and my parents to speak up and say, I feel this way. Why do I feel this way? I need some help. That's why it all spiraled out of control.
Yeah, that's, oh man. But at age 14, you're not thinking I'm addicted to this. You're thinking I found the magic freaking potion. I took Adderall and I started in college. And I remember this resonated really well with me from your book, because I took this Adderall pill that I'd gotten from my girlfriend, because she's like, you're ADD, I can tell. You're just like my brother. So she goes and grabs one, and I took one, and I went, holy shit, this is how normal people feel every day. They're not trying so hard to pay attention to what the teacher's saying and then being like, I wonder if that light is like the same kind of light as the shit, where we are again in the book. And then the teacher's like, you're an idiot. What are you doing here? You know, and I thought, if I can take this every day, I'm going to be just fine in college. I'm going to be just fine in law school. I just doubled my capacity to learn. I feel funny. I feel awake and alive. Everyone's laughing at my jokes, and those that aren't, I don't even care. Whereas that would have sent me back to my dorm room like, she doesn't like me. None of that anymore. All gone. And that was a scary feeling after a while, because I was taking it every day. I got a prescription for it, by the way, by telling the doctor, hey, so I took my friend's brother's medication and it worked great. And he's like, sure enough, here you go. Some amphetamines, which is what Adderall really is. Looking back, I'm going, what are you thinking? Isn't there a test for this? But that's a little scary now because I remember taking it. And then summer came around. The Beetlejuice chair is so loud. I was taking it. Summer came around and I go, well, I'm just going to keep refilling this shit. And my girlfriend's like, why? We don't have school. And I was like, have you seen me on and off? I mean, why would I stop doing
it? Why would you stop doing it?
And I go to the doctor and he goes, hey, you know, kids are dying from taking this. They're having heart attacks. And I was like, and that won't happen to me, which is what all addicts, I think, do. But when a doctor prescribes it,
it's okay.
That went on for years until I went, you know, the doctor that prescribed this to me was an idiot, and I knew that at the time. So I don't think the fact that I have this piece of paper means that my brain is fine with this.
There you go.
But that took me a long time to come around. And I don't know if amphetamines are as addictive as opiates. I don't really know if there's a scale or...
They're up there. There's a lot of people in the world of recovery from Adderall and Ritalin.
Yeah. If I hadn't been taking extended release, I think we might be having this conversation while I'm crushing them up in the bathroom and putting them up my nose.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's hard to say. It didn't even occur to me till I read this book that I probably had that. So you're 14. You're kind of hooked on Demerol. How are you getting it at 14 after camp?
Well, it took me probably about a year until I was able to start getting it either from the streets or just friends' parents that had it that started making money. I sat down with my dad one night. I was 14 years old. I said, I need to get insurance on my baseball cards. He thought I was nuts. He's like,
sure.
What do you mean insurance? I said, I need about 8 or 9 worth of insurance. He's like, all right, can you bring down a list so I can see this? And he's like, Darren, that says 8 or 9,000. I was like, yeah, I'm not talking 8 or 900. He goes, how the hell do you have 8 or 9,000 worth of cards? I show him this price guide. Anybody that collected back in the '80s,
Beckett?
It was called CCP. Now everybody says Beckett. Current card price guide. It was a newspaper.
Okay.
CCP. It came out before Beckett. And I sat down with him and he challenged me. He goes, who's going to buy these though? This Mickey Mantle card for $200. This Reggie Jackson rookie for $75. I said, oh, it's funny. You should ask. I pull out this newspaper ad and there was a show at the Holiday Inn in Livingston, New Jersey for $25. I got a table and I shared it with my good friend, Steve Simon, who runs my agency to this day. And
wait.
He went into it. We shared the table. He went into it as a hobby, just maybe have a fun day selling cards.
Yeah.
I went into it as a business. I spent 2 weeks every night, the perfect holders, the perfect price guides. And I made over $1,000 in a Sunday afternoon at 14 years old. And the light bulb went on. So now I had money. I was deeply insecure. You know, apparently a severe learning disability, had this passion and this love affair already with opiates.
Yeah. Oh, man. That is a recipe for disaster. Insecure, starts making money way too early. I mean, if there was a YouTube back then, you'd just be...
I'd be a billionaire,
yeah.
Guys.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, it might have ended tragically.
That's
a little earlier. Yeah. But I would imagine, like, you're in school, you're ADD, you can't focus. Amen, brother. I hear you on that. I mean, that's the story of my life. My mom was a special ed teacher. That's probably why I wasn't in special ed, because she's like, no, my son's not in special ed. I teach special ed. But I think half my teachers were like, this kid is going to be in prison. The other half that were teaching things I was actually interested in, like science, they were like, he should be in the gifted program. So they were butting heads like, wait, he's not a total a-hole idiot in your class? And I'm sure you had one or two teachers that thought you were special, and the rest of them were like, is this thing on? You're a knucklehead.
I had two teachers. It's exactly what it was. Two that believed in me.
The other element of this, you're in the baseball card trade. I would imagine that you're thinking as a teenager, I got a car or two. I've got my magic potion that nobody has to know about. Girls are starting to pay attention because I'm the only guy who can fill the car with gas and drive a new car and not picking her up on my bike. You probably thought, I can hold this shit together. I'm faking it. Everyone's believing this. So I'm good.
Absolutely.
I went to an AA meeting with a friend of mine several times because I'm curious about that stuff. And a lot of people told stories like that. Like, you fake it until suddenly you realize everyone knows, but you're the only one. You're the last one in on the joke.
That the gig is up.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
You're getting heavy in the baseball card trade. I'm finding it really funny that the guy that you started with now works with you. I mean, what are the odds of that?
I know. And he's great. We still laugh about it to this day. I mean, he does amazing at my agency. So he's the vice president and he was with me during a very special time in my life. And he's there again now.
Terrible at selling baseball cards, really good at wrangling A-list talent.
Exactly.
So you're dealing with adults, though, as a kid. You're 14, 15.
I was the only person in school, teachers included, that had a cell phone. Back then, it was called Bell Atlantic. Not the big rubber ones that you saw in a night at the Roxbury.
Okay.
These were a big metal aluminum battery on the bottom of a leather case with a rubber antenna. It was Bell Atlantic, and it would be in my locker in between class, and it was $3 a minute to use this phone. So I would call stockbrokers in between class, find out what cards they wanted. There was no internet back then, no texting. I would have to call different dealers, get the cards. Hey, bring it to the show this week and I'll pick it up. I'd buy a Mickey Mantle card for $2,000. I'd flip it to the investor for $3,000. That was my life.
Unbelievable. And your teachers didn't care that you had a cell phone in the school?
Well, I was in between class. I was respectful enough to not, because my dad always put me on notice. And he was big on education. My mom was more so, but my dad had that business hustle. He was always successful businessman. He knew this was my calling. He knew school wasn't for me.
That's lucky though, right? I mean, they could have just tried to hammer you into that square hole.
I got in a lot of trouble in college because of my business. I dropped out after 1 year.
What did your dad think of all this? I mean, he must have at first been like, you should probably focus on school. Like, what was the turning point where he went, okay?
He knew the second weekend because I think I made about $2,000 after making $1,000 the week before. And being an old school Jewish father, it really like lit him up. And
yeah.
Like I said, he was a big time entrepreneur, very successful at a very young age. And
what did he do?
He was in direct mail coupon advertising, something similar to Valpak.
Got it. Yeah.
But it was all over the state of New Jersey. And so to see his son have this hustle in him and having no clue what I'm doing, but saw me go to one end of the room with a wad of cash, come back with a bunch of cards, and then see by the end of the show, 4 hours later, those cards get into a double wad of cash that I had the morning we got to the show.
Right. Like you have twice as many cards and twice as much cash. Yep. What's happening right now?
Yeah. Because again, the insecurities and the feeling of less than. And in that show on that floor, I felt so alive. But when I was back in my bedroom by myself at night, I felt like that broken piece of crap again. I always felt like I didn't belong. So I would lie about the money. He would ask me, how much did I make? Let's go over it. And I would shove a couple thousand under the mattress because, hey, it's a 15, 16-year-old kid drumming in high school. I needed it. I needed to have that money in my pocket so I could take people out for lunch, for dinner, take my friends out, you know, take my friend shopping. I wanted to, similar to Dennis Rodman with the watches. I was that way with that money. I needed to buy people's love and attention and affection, and that's what I did with it.
We're talking about how Dennis Rodman stole 50 watches while he was a janitor at the airport and then just gave them away to his friends. And the idea was, I want people to like me.
Yep.
You're weirdly, right? Like sneaking money away from your dad so he doesn't do anything responsible with it. And then turning around and like
doing something completely irresponsible just to buy fake friends.
Like, not horrible. Like, well, the drug thing, not so good. But you weren't going to the strip club or buying hookers or whatever.
At 16 years old, you couldn't.
You were like, let's all go to McDonald's.
I take everybody to the mall.
Yeah.
Go for a nice Italian restaurant. And I got the taxis taken care of because you weren't driving at 16.
Right. No.
I would just get, you know, 10, 12 of my boys and we'd all go to the batting cages for the day and play mini golf. And it was always on Prince. Everybody knew that Prince was covering the tab.
That's like the weirdest sort of like drug dealer bling ever though, right? Like baseball cards, batting cages, arcade, and I don't know, like
bowling.
Macaroni grill or whatever. Yeah, bowling. Balling out of control on Prince. So, but are you like high during this time or are you just spending money to stay
sporadically,
out?
Not as much. It didn't really start until my senior year in college with getting high. But you know, I would party occasionally on the weekends. I wasn't the biggest like party animal. I have a lot of my guy and girlfriends call me to come out. And some of these girls, I remember I wrote about in the book, I get these messages, stop playing with your stupid baseball cards and come to this party. And nothing got in the way of my baseball cards. I didn't care. I was on a mission. I was just so focused that I was a late bloomer with dating. Didn't matter. I wasn't bothered by it.
Plus, when you're an entrepreneur, you're like, are you kind of still kind of a workaholic? I am.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the thing I like doing the most.
I love it, man.
I'm married and I have a kid and my wife, like, she gets it. She's like, just be there for your kid enough, be there for me enough. But I get it if you like don't want to watch Netflix, but you want to go over your show notes five more times.
And in my business too, as an agent, I truly have this mindset that I'm only good as my last deal. So no matter how close I am with Hulk or Magic or Dennis or Ric Flair or somebody on any given day, I got to bring the heat again. I tell my office, you celebrate that deal today, you get up tomorrow morning, let's go out and find another one.
It's that never-ending hustle, but that requires never-ending energy. You can't rest on your laurels. Not everyone can handle that.
It's like drinking water to me at this point. It's so easy. You know, you've been doing it so long. So many people in my life don't understand how I'm able to function, and it's super easy. And I, you know, a lot of it is the balance, too, my 12-step program. I know how to take time to myself when I need it and check out.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Darren Prince. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard from our amazing sponsors, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode, so you can make sure you solidify your understanding of the key takeaways from Darren Prince. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all of the latest episodes downloaded automatically to your podcast player, so you don't miss a single thing. And now back to our show with Darren Prince.
How long have you been sober?
11 and a half years.
So that's a long time. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a long time. I met you today. We talked before, but we have mutual friends. You know, you're a warm guy, or at least you're really good at faking it so far. But everybody...
We're talking about Jennifer Cohn.
Yeah, talking about Jennifer Cohn. I think what she saw in common was that vibe of like going out, getting it, doing it right, hustling your ass off, and also being a competitive son of a bitch a little bit here and there.
And like my dad saying, his favorite expression, it's not what you say, it's what you do. So if I'm going to tell Jordan I'm going to do something and then give you a contact or hook you up with something, you better believe Darren Prince is going to do it. I think that's the way we are from the East Coast, to be honest with you, because she always tells me, I cannot believe when you said you're going to do this, it's just in me.
That was what she said we had in common. I always do what I say I'm going to do. That in LA, it's like you're an
rarity,
alien.
Right?
You're an alien, man, out here, California, Southern California. So I said I was going to do this thing and I did it. Yeah, but I thought you forgot.
I didn't think you were really going to show up.
I mean, you don't have to call and confirm 14 times. Like I said, I'll be there on Tuesday. I'm still coming on Tuesday. Yeah. So you're 16 years old, making what, like 200 grand a year?
A couple hundred grand a year at that
point. And what year was this?
1986.
Okay. So inflation calculator, that's like $300,000 or something.
Probably at least, I would imagine.
If not more. Yeah. 30 plus years ago, 35 mm-hmm. years ago, almost. So suddenly you became a cool kid. You went from special ed kid to like, this is the kid who makes more money than both of my parents, all of our parents put together.
Written up in the Daily News, USA Today, all these things started happening.
How did you learn to conduct business? Some of it's instinctual, but what's the rest of it?
Again, I always go back to my dad. You know, I miss him so much. And he just taught me, you know, it's not what you say, it's what you do. Your reputation's the hardest thing to uphold, the easiest thing to lose. You only get one chance at it. The idea is 1%, carrying it through is the other 99%. And I always took these three things with me. And he was so big on personal relationships, not just when I became an agent, but baseball cards, sports memorabilia, get to know them. Find out what their special interests are, when their birthdays are. Find out about their family, brothers, sisters, their friends, know what their passions are. And I did that, and I studied that on almost everybody, because when it came to that, it was exciting. It wasn't like reading U.S. history or Spanish, and I gravitated to it. And, you know, like I kind of stored it. So I knew when I would see somebody, hey, man, how's the dog doing? Or how's the... And it was almost like they were so taken back.
Yeah.
And that I was so attentive to those details that it just continuously cultivated a relationship.
Do you keep the notes in your head or do you keep them... Back then, you didn't keep them in your phone. But
back then, you didn't keep it in your phone. Now, I truly believe I was a statistical genius when it came to math. I would study the back of baseball cards as a teenager, and I can tell you what Daryl Strawberry hit in 1983 playing in the minor leagues, how many home runs, how many RBIs, and... That was one thing that gave me a sense of self and some self-confidence, because when my boys would be arguing about sports or like how many singles a guy got like three nights ago, they would say, ask Prince, he would know. So it made me actually feel good about myself. And I think that's why I gravitated more to studying statistics of basketball players, baseball players, because I was the go-to guy.
You could have been an actuary. That would have been exciting. Yeah. Sorry, actuaries. We do have some that listen to the show.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. We're laughing with you. How did you find mentors? You mentioned mentors in the book, and I was wondering if maybe because you had a great dad, you had good radar for other good people.
You know, people just pop into my life too. God's plan, whatever it might have been, in any sector of the business or whatever business it was at that time, I always had great people. Like baseball cards, Barry Halper lived 10 minutes from my family's house, who passed away. He was the legendary card collector, memorabilia collector, had the holy grail of all collections of all time. And then when I got into sports memorabilia, I had my friend Jeff Hamilton, a renowned leather jacket designer, introduced me to Harlan Werner, who's Muhammad Ali's agent for close to 30 years. And he brought me into the Ali family. And then it obviously evolved into the agency and Magic Johnson. To this day, I own my life. I mean, the guy took a chance on me and gave me the opportunity to bring him opportunities. And I thank him every day that I'm with him.
Yeah, the story with Magic is interesting because what, you were setting up signings of memorabilia?
I was doing his autograph signings through his agent at the time, Lon Rosen, who's also a dear friend. And Lon was his player rep for many years. And, you know, they didn't allow many people into that shell. I mean, it was a very tight circle. But, you know, Lon liked my hustle. He knew I did things right. I was honest. I worked my butt off. And Magic liked the organization when he would show up at certain appearances with Mike Frew. I would always pay extra people to be there because I'm like, this is about building a relationship. I don't want to be understaffed. And to this day, I still deal with his private jet information with his assistant, Natalie Wilson, who I love, his car services. I don't let anybody in my office even go near that. Those little things. Because if there's a screw up, it's on Darren Prince, you know, and I'm like that with most of my guys.
Wow. You're really hands on with your clients, yeah. Even to this day.
I'll double check their hotel confirmations. Yeah. I'll double check with security at airports for Hulk Hogan with my boy Chris Volo, who always makes sure it's hard for Hulk to walk to an airport for Hulk Hogan.
Oh, so yeah.
We'll make sure the golf carts are in a certain area. Ric Flair and his wife, Wendy, they know the way I am. I mean, I'm very OCD with it. They're my family. I want to make sure when they get somewhere, it's as easy as an experience as possible. I don't want them getting bombarded by 300 fans. I want them getting in, getting out, getting to the hotel, getting rested. If there's a certain food they like or certain drink, I make sure it's there.
Jeez, man. It's hard to even buy that kind of care.
Yeah, and then the most important thing when they hurt and when life happens to them, I'm one of the first people there to speak to them.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. Dennis Rodman earlier was saying a lot of people are fair weather fans. Like, they like you when you're up, but then when you're low, it's like they're laughing at you or they're just ignoring you.
I was there for all the North Korean trips, and yeah, there was some ugly times after that. Third or fourth trip, I think it was the fourth trip in January 2014. It got very scary. And I went and turned my back on him. I talked him into going into rehab because his drinking was escalating. And that's when you find out the true meaning of friendship. I don't want to just be there for people when they're on top. I want to be there when they're struggling, you know, because I know firsthand living through it that I found my real true self from the adversity in my life. And if people turn their back on me, I wouldn't be alive right here.
Sure. I wonder if there's a part of you that looks at the opiate problem in like a kid who grows up in rural Montana and you go, of course it's hard for you to get sober. I'm an agent with money and resources and access to anyone in the world that I want to fly to. And it was hard for me to get sober. Like, what chance does a kid have who works at a gas station?
Same thing. Exactly. Everybody needs to, you know, just accept the fact that there might be a problem, have the courage to speak to somebody about that problem. It doesn't matter. I say it all the time, whether you're from Park Avenue or Park Bench or Yale or jail, addiction doesn't discriminate. It all comes down to taking that first step, taking that action to identify that, how did it get to this point? Or I don't want it to keep escalating and I want to stop it now. And I can't do it by myself.
Yeah. How do you do that? I heard you on Dr. Drew, who's a mutual friend of ours.
We had dinner two nights ago with Dennis.
That's right. He texted me, or I texted him right before that. And I said, do you know anything about this Suboxone drug? And he's like, gotta go. And I was like, oh, well, hit me later. And then it turned out he was, yeah, with you guys looking at brain scans or something.
I have a crazy story about Suboxone with Dr. Drew. When Dennis was on Celebrity Rehab in 2005, Dr. Drew called me and I thought I was sober. I truly did. I was on Suboxone for a year and a half at that point.
And this is like a drug that's supposed to drop opiates?
Yeah, it's an opiate blocker. It basically takes away the cravings. If you do happen to take an opiate, it blocks it. There's no psychological euphoria effect from it. I thought I was living my best life, and he called me out right on the phone. He goes, Darren, I don't really know you, but I'm going to tell you that's highly dangerous. And the Suboxone after a year and a half is even more addictive now to your system than real opiates were. And damn, he was right. I mean, that was a nightmare getting off that stuff. So we knew each other. He's done some press with my book. He attended a big event that Jason Bin did in New York with Magic and I, and been a big supporter. So we kind of laugh about it, but it was a turning point because who knows? I might have just stayed on Suboxone the rest of my life thinking I found the cure.
Jeez. So I didn't realize that it's kind of like methadone, right?
It's exactly like methadone.
They come out with this and then it turns out it's just as bad or worse and harder to get and more expensive.
Exactly.
So, all right. We can sort of come back to that in a second because there was a little bit of a downfall at that point that leads to all this. But you're a big dog at the card conventions. And I love this quote, money and power don't mean anything if you yourself don't mean something. How do you come to that realization at age 16 when you're balling out of control and all your friends love you?
I don't think I did. I think I realized it when I was sober, when me and Kristen were writing the book. You're right, because back then it was about the jewelry and the diamonds, and I would have three or four beautiful models come into these shows with me, and everybody wearing Prince of Cards jackets, and I wasn't Darren Prince anymore. I had an alter ego. It was Prince of Cards, and it's just the coolest thing in the world. You know, whatever, 16, 17, 18, walking into a
satin
convention.
Jackets?
Yes.
White satin, I'm envisioning.
I don't know. It's white. No, I think it was navy with gold.
But certainly satin.
The flashier, the better.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was back then.
And you're this like Jewish kid who I assume had a bunch of really gaudy ass jewelry on.
Exactly. I had a diamond dollar sign ring that I would wear at that. If there was the last piece of jewelry in the world, I wouldn't be wearing it to this day, but it was horrendous looking. I lived in that thing. I slept in it. I bought it at like a flea market vendor for like $5,000 one day, and it was like everything to me. People would stop me. I guess back then in 86, 87, it might have been considered cool.
Oh, man.
But, you know, I look back to see how deeply insecure and hurt that Darren Prince was to have to wear a dollar sign diamond ring. Look at me now.
Yeah, no rings.
You
just
know.
Is that like a Zen?
No, this is a recovery bracelet. And this is a, you know, same thing about spiritual energy and good vibes. And
I'm trying to even think who had a dollar sign diamond ring made.
Not cubic zirconia, real diamonds.
Right, real diamonds, yeah. So like this is like some stuff that got pawned when a drug dealer got arrested.
Exactly.
It was in his drawer.
Yeah.
Some like Iceberg Slim lost it at
a
bar. Oh my God. But you're still in the high life. Like you're going on Arsenio Hall, successful teenagers.
Well, no, that one never happened.
That one never happened?
That one never happened. I'll never forget the call. This was another lesson from my dad, Danny Zucker, who I know is very big time in the industry still, calls me up. I was at Bridgeport. I was a freshman in college. Said, we read about you in the USA Today, and Arsenio Hall is doing an amazing segment on successful teenagers. And he's got you. I think the girl was from Soho Soda out of Long Island and one other person. Because we're going to fly you out in 2 weeks. We'll have our office call you. So, of course, as an insecure, cocky, arrogant Jewish kid, start calling up my friends.
I'm going
out. Everybody in the dorm room's going nuts. We're all going out that night, getting wasted to celebrate. I call my dad the next morning. He goes, he didn't tell anybody yet, did you? I was like, oh, no, I told a couple.
A couple people. Yeah.
He goes, Darren, learn one thing. Until you're on that set of that studio, not on the plane, until you walk in and they mic you up, you have nothing. And about 4 days later, he called me to break my heart and say they're moving away from the segment. But I did get USA Today. I think there was like Sally, Jesse Raphael,
oh
the New
God.
York Post, Wall Street Journal. But Arsenio would have been in. I mean,
yeah.
I could have had Jeff Hamilton's jacket on with the diamonds. I mean, what an entrance.
Would you have shown up with the ring and the jacket?
Forget about it.
Oh,
it's been
man.
Unbelievable. With the Versace glasses with the gold on the side.
Yeah, you look like Jewish T.I. A Jewish Flavor Flav. Oh, man. Your dad did have some good advice, though. He said, your reputation is the hardest thing to build and the easiest thing to lose. That's a very dad quote, right?
Exactly.
Your whole scene is based on reputation, but man, there's a lot of people that are around Dennis Rodman, around Hulk Hogan, all your clients, you yourself, that are out to get you, out to get something from you all the time. How do you know who to trust? How do you know who's going to have your reputation in mind?
I mean, at this stage, I don't think we bring many new people into the personal circle. It's more corporate.
Yeah.
You know, any type of business partnerships. But you know, most of my guys are so smart. They know. You know, Hulk's got his tight circle. Ric Flair does. Charlie Sheen does. Everybody's got, obviously, Magic is, you know, it's like Fort Knox to get in there. And I think they know at their age at this point who the real people and who the ones that you have to kind of keep away and out of that little tight-knit spot because everybody wants something out of them. And that's the other reason I tell my guys in my office, I think we're so successful with them. Not just professionally, but personally, I'm not that guy that asked for anything. I've never been. I did it one time in my life, and it's in the book on the back cover right there. And it's the fact that Magic Johnson, Magic Johnson wrote the forward. They know me. I don't do that. I don't want to be that guy. I want to be the guy that's calling them because I have an opportunity for them, not to take something from them.
I have trouble with that, too. It took me years to even ask for help with things that people wanted to give me. It took me a long time to even go, well, I really need this thing, and I know that this person can do it. What do you think that is? It goes to the unworthiness, right?
I think there's a little bit of unworthiness,
too,
a little bit. I think that still obviously always stays inside to us to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But see, this one, I went all for it. I mean, when I emailed Mark Cuban, Jeannie Boss, all my people, they got right back. Social media, my Patrick Canino's here, and we were talking about it 2 nights ago. The amount of social media support he got when Aiming High came out was just unbelievable. But that was because I knew it was helping so many people. I felt so secure with asking because I knew that so many were affected by this. And there's not a person in this hotel today or in the city of Los Angeles that doesn't know somebody affected by the opiate epidemic or alcoholism. And, you know, that was one time in my life I truly felt like I deserve this. God's given me this platform and I'm going to ask them to help me excel it to a whole nother level to help save lives.
Of course, yeah. Like if this book was just about you and there's a bunch of selfies with you and famous people, it would have been harder for you to ask
exactly
for that, for sure. Going back to our wild insecurities as teenagers, you started lifting weights and doing steroids and stuff like that. You know, that obviously is the same pathology coming into play. that caused all kinds of health problems. I mean, at this point, give us a picture of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. You're drinking, you're popping pills.
I'm popping pills, making tens of thousands of dollars a week, flipping and buying and selling vintage baseball cards, and finally got beautiful women in my life, you know, the pick of whatever I wanted, which again was something new that I wasn't used to. And in the gym 6 days a week, injecting steroids, taking pills of steroids. And I thought life was great, that this was it. I mean, everybody wanted to hang out with me. Everyone wanted to be in my inner circle. And I wanted everybody to be in my inner circle.
Sure, yeah.
I needed it. I loved it. I loved the attention. I loved the fact that I finally felt like something in my life.
Man, I can totally identify with all this. I think that's why I like the book, because I was just like, oh my God, I took a lot of these boxes. That's why I'm careful.
You gotta laugh. We made it through, man.
Well, yeah. When I look at addictive behavior and things like that, I go, well, I don't really have that. But it's so not true. I definitely have that. I just don't have it with substances, and that's probably ... yet, right? Like, I'm always wary of that now. Looking in LA, some of my friends that were like the fitness trainer guys, they're freaking snorting heroin now.
Exactly.
And I'm like, what happened to you, you know? And it's not just Hollywood.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Whoa, man, it's terrifying. So you must have been having a great time, but at some point, it hits the fan, right? You hit the wall.
21 years old.
What happens?
I was arrested 4 times in 6 months.
But of course, all that was a coincidence, right?
It wasn't. Every time.
Yeah.
The cops never should have been there. Yeah, it's bad timing. And I was put into a program called the Alliance by the judge. I lost my license for a year, and it was mandatory I stayed sober. Otherwise, he said it was 120 days in jail. So, you know, I got my life in order, and maybe a few days to go in the program, and I knew I was graduating, per se. I called my friend Dave up, and I said, hey, man, I got this great idea. Let's go to New York City and celebrate. Let's go do some mind erasure.
What should go wrong?
At Jimmy Cafe. We were just 21, and we just partied our ass off there on the way, and we took a handful of Xanax, which I thought were better than the opiates, because the opiates is what also got me in trouble. And between that and the mind erasure shots, we're on our way home from New York City, and I wake up in the ER with 100 stitches in my face. He fell asleep behind the wheel. His car went into a ditch. My face went into the windshield. Concussion, broken nose, my lip split open. You wouldn't have recognized me. And the first two people I see are my mom and my dad. Tears rolling down my face.
Oh, man.
Because they can't help their baby boy.
Did they know?
They knew, but a little blind by the fact, how can he be this successful?
Yeah, I wonder about that.
If there's really a problem, you know?
Like, and no, he's got a car and a business and his friends, and he's always...
My first condo at 21 years old, that's unheard of at that
time. Yeah, that's crazy.
You know, for $400,000. But I knew there was an issue. I knew something wasn't right, but I wasn't ready to give it all up. I wanted to kind of adjust it. I knew that maybe the Xanax with the booze wasn't right, and I couldn't do coke, and the ecstasy, doing it 2-3 days a week wasn't good for me. And I eventually wanted to find that balance of what worked, where I could still feel the way I wanted to feel, but not go overboard.
What's crazy to me is you're working with, at this point, athletes and...
Back then, I was doing the signings, yeah. I wasn't in the agent game yet.
But even still, you're working with like these world-class athletes and personalities. And I think it was a Joe Frazier waking up at 3 a.m. doing 5-mile runs with ankle weights, or was it Muhammad Ali, or was it both?
Joe Frazier would tell me those stories. Yeah.
I mean, and you're working with them, and then you're thinking, cool, well, what did I do last night? I did a bunch of pills, and then drank a bunch, and then hit the gym and injected some steroids. And then, I mean, how are you squaring their greatness with like, your lifestyle?
Well, you know, when I started working with the athletes and I had morality clauses in my agreement, that's when I got rid of the illegal drugs. And I really had sciatica. I mean, I had real hardcore sciatica, probably from the stresses and not knowing how to release them and a lot of those underlying insecurities that were compressed that I didn't know how to deal with. And, you know, when the craziness of the agency game would happen, I just knew to go right to the bottle. I was functioning for a while. Most of my guys will tell you that were around me. They didn't think there was a problem. They just thought Prince was having a good time. And, you know, I was up early. I'd made sure they made their flights. I made sure everybody got paid. The contracts were done right. I had a great team behind me. But eventually, like I said, you know, it's a certain point where it turned on me. I cannot tell you to this day when it turned on me, but it turned and it stopped working.
You can't really pinpoint the time?
No. There was a time maybe in my early 30s where it just didn't have the effect that it once had. I remember walking into an event, believe it or not, at this hotel. The Mondrian we're at right now. I think it might have been maybe 2001. I was with Smokin' Joe, and it was the ESPY Awards after party. And I think Tom Brady just won his first Super Bowl. And I remember leaving the ESPY Awards and chopped up a couple Percocets and went in the bathroom to snort them. and we came in the limo over here to go to the after party, and I felt nothing. I felt nothing. Nothing. And now here I am walking in with the King of Kings, and I felt like I lost my mojo. I'm like, dude, there's been all these athletes. Samuel Jackson's going to see him, which just hosted the awards. I'm not going to communicate. I'm not going to talk. I remember my hands started getting all sweaty. And that was probably the first time I walked into an event where I felt like I lost my superpowers. And ironically, I saw Kobe Bryant here that night, too. I just worked with him. I just had him on.
Yeah.
And my boy said, you know, with him, I wrote about it in the book. He saw me go over to him and he goes, you had that little flash of greatness. Like you were able to walk over. Hey, man, what's up? But then the rest of the night, you weren't yourself.
Oh, man. So that must have then spoke to your insecurity as not being worthy of being there in the first place, which is really, really scary to have that come crawling back after you've done all this to beat that down.
Up here,
to mute that. You're like, how many drugs do I have to do to get rid of that? And here it is creeping back in. It's like wherever you go, there you are, right?
Exactly.
Oh, man. And you're doing so well with your clients at this point, right? Because you're not just a businessman, you're a fan, and the clients can tell.
Exactly.
And you'd land Ali, Magic Johnson.
Evel Knievel, Hulk, yeah, Ric Flair, Roy Jones Jr., Rodman. There were so many. Chevy Chase, to this day, is a client. And always making sure I got the job done.
For addicts, the night before looks different, but the morning after always looks the same. Barfing either on Skid Row or into a golden toilet in Trump Tower. That's like the great equalizer, but in a very, very unglamorous way. How did you figure that out? How did that become something you felt viscerally and realized?
Whenever I would come to, I think I would look at my surroundings. And although there was a certain woman there, a lady friend, and I just celebrated a certain success, I always knew no matter where the environment is, I always woke up to the same atmosphere. It was always something with that energy related to whatever party I was doing. Didn't matter if I was in a Holiday Inn or a Ritz-Carlton. It was always that same hungover, even if it's an opiate over, as I like to call them, too many, nauseous, not feeling right. Always came down to that, no matter where I was geographically.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Darren Prince. Thank you for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard so you can check out those amazing sponsors for yourself, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget, we have a worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. If you're listening to us on the Overcast player, please click that little star next to the episode. We really appreciate it. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Darren Prince.
I can barely keep it together after two drinks. Like, I wake up the next morning, I'm like, oh, I'm too old for this shit. Your liver must have been on seventh gear.
My liver enzymes 11 and a half years later are still slightly elevated from all the opiates.
Like bilirubin count or something?
Yeah, there's, you know, a handful of ailments that I have. I lost my hearing completely.
Oh, that's from
25
that.
25 years old. I firmly believe, as do some of the doctors, is from excessive opiate use. I think Rush Limbaugh has a hearing problem. He's a very well-known TV announcer, and you know he was an opiate addict. And one of the big side effects from long-term opiate abuse is hearing loss.
Huh. I guess I never really thought about that. That's terrifying. I guess it's lucky that's the only thing that you lost, right? Is hearing in one ear? Jeez.
Just the left ear.
Jeez. The book reads like part music video and then part maybe like a Crystal Method music video. You know, it's like music. Oh, rap music video. Oh, EDM music video. You're in strip clubs with celebrities. You're on jets and things like that. But all of this contributes to your sense of not really belonging, right? Like the whole imposter syndrome. It makes it all worse, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it made it all worse. In that moment, I don't recognize it. I don't realize it. I can't identify with it. But there was a certain point like that next morning or whatever it might have been where I couldn't get that feeling back. And I was struggling to find it no matter how many pills I took or however I timed it to not take them on a full stomach and only snort half of them and let the rest go under my tongue and melt. It was absolute insanity. Whatever I had to do was a full-time job to make sure I got that fix that I needed.
Jeez, so you're managing your addiction is like this whole routine. Manage addiction, sleep, eat.
Exactly.
Yeah, unbelievable. First. Doing business at the level where you are and where you were even then, you had to have your reputation intact. You had to have your integrity intact. Didn't you ever think, holy shit, what if I get caught doing all these drugs?
No, because they were legal. They were prescribed by a doctor, as we talked about. Doctor wrote them.
Yeah.
I'm good.
So it's all good.
Yeah. There was no, back then, all you need to do is travel with OxyContin or Percocets. I'm sure it's the same. Or Vicodin, just have a prescription bottle with your name on it. And that was it. I mean, like I said, I did cut out the illegal drugs. I knew there was no more, you know, ecstasy, coke, all that other crap. I was done with that once I became an agent. So I just shifted into opiates.
There was a little scare with the integrity, though, with the FBI. Tell us how the FBI and you got involved with one another, because that was kind of terrifying.
So that's how I made my transition into the agency game. I had Prince of Cards, which was my memorabilia company. We were at the height of the business. We were the king of autograph signings. I literally just left Muhammad Ali at the Essex House in New York City. This was in 1996 in the summer. We spent 2 days with him signing the photos of him lighting the Olympic torch, which he did 2 weeks prior. I got a voicemail from an FBI agent. I'm writing a column in Tough Stuff magazine called The Autograph Experience about all these icons that I'm around and what the experience was like. And I called the officer on a Sunday night. He said, we'd love to have you come to Chicago. There's a case we could use your expertise. We'll fly you in. We'll pay you. Of course, the ego, the big shot.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
That's a brilliant move on their part, though.
Yeah.
Like, plays every
right,
card.
Of course, they're calling me because I'm Darren Prince. I just left Muhammad Ali. And so the next morning, I got a call from another FBI agent telling me that we may need you to come with an attorney to look at some merchandise that we have.
Ooh.
It's like, this is really odd. So I call up my attorney. He goes, don't call them back. Let me call them. He's like, I think you should bring me. I'll charge you a couple grand for the day. Let's go in and out. And the night before I left, the provider of this merchandise that I bought a lot of it from, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of autograph memorabilia, told me that the FBI was trying to get him on tax evasion and not to give them any information on him. Developed a relationship with the guy. It's like, whatever, I'm bulletproof. I did nothing wrong.
Sure.
I go out there and they sat with me for about 2 hours. They recorded everything. And the one question they asked that they kept pushing me on was, did you ever have any inquiries, Mr. Prince, for refunds from any of your customers? I go, no. I go, everybody loved the merchandise. It was authenticated by one of your own, an FBI forensic document expert. Okay, no problem. So we'll take a break. We come back after lunch. So we're going to ask you one more time, Mr. Prince, are you sure and certain that nobody in your office ever had an issue with the refund? It's like, no, never. They had a tape recorder. It wasn't of our conversation. They were tapping my phone lines for 6 months.
Wow.
One of my sales rep arguing with an attorney in Hawaii trying to return some merchandise, saying he got word that it was fake and it wasn't really signed by Michael Jordan. They investigated me for about another year and a half. I lost everything financially. So I started sending out refund letters to keep my reputation intact, and it was devastating. You know, probably half the people took a refund, to be honest with you. So many of them loved the merchandise and the autographs looked so legit. Some people didn't want to believe that it was fake. But I lost everything. I wound up about $1 million in debt.
Oh, man.
This was the first time in my life I had financial problems. My friends were giving me $200-$300 a week just to eat. My condo was almost in foreclosure. And my last $3,000 that I had from writing some of these articles in Tough Stuff magazine, I decided to take my dad to a fishing trip in Alaska, and that's kind of when everything changed. A week before we left, I got sentenced to 3 years probation. All these icons came through for me. Magic Johnson and Lon Rose and his agent at the time sent letters to the judge, Lonnie Ali, Muhammad Ali, Harlan Werner, Dwight Manley, and Dennis Rodman, Dennis's longtime player rep, about my credibility, that I made a mistake.
But what was your mistake? That's confusing.
Basically, I lied to the FBI. I got charged with making a false statement.
Did you do that deliberately or you weren't?
No, I truly believed we didn't have any issues with refunds.
Yeah.
I never heard about it because when my rep was talking to the attorney in Hawaii, he didn't tell me that there was an issue. He's like, you bought these items from us 8 months ago. How do we know they're still ours? That was what he said to me.
Yeah.
So because they couldn't get me on mail fraud, because there was no proof that I did anything intentionally, they cut a deal with me and they charged me with making a false statement to the FBI.
Oh,
so
that's
I got
like
3 years probation.
Gotcha.
Still a felony. I'm a felon, so can't do jury duty, thank God. But I'm allowed to vote. I've been able to vote.
Oh, wait. So you could, the only, wait a minute. So
it's a pretty cool thing in a way.
So you just don't ever have to go to jury duty.
Jordan, when the jury duty cards come in, I get so excited to go online and fill it in because the minute I check that box, have I ever been charged with a felony? It X's me right out. Every couple of years it comes in and says, sorry, you're unable to qualify.
All I have to do is become a felon. Life hack. Not so, recommended at all.
So, you know, obviously, it took me a while to come out of it, but I took my dad with my last like $3,000 to Alaska, and he refused to. He didn't want to go with me because you can't be wasting this money. And I said, Dad, come on, we need it. Let's just go. And as I talk about in the book, we were fishing, and we talked about it earlier that I said to him, I need to do something different. He goes, what's your next move? And I said, you know, Dad, I think I'd make a great agent. I think I'd be really good at it because I'm caring. I'm good with details. These guys trust me. These women that I represent, they all trust me. But I'm not an attorney, and at 25, I don't want to go to law school. He goes, why do you need to be an attorney? He goes, life is about who you know, not what you know. He goes, you have so many incredible relationships. Be able to go to Muhammad Ali's ranch in Michigan, and to go to Magic Johnson's house, and you can call Dennis Rodman on the cell phone right now, or Joe Frazier. Like, these are relationships that any attorney would give their right arm for in the entertainment industry. And so what are you saying? What should I do? Because Magic stuck by you through all of this. He knows about making mistakes. They all do. I would talk to him next time you see him about being your first client. And I remember being in Michigan with him. We were in Detroit about 3 weeks later. And I remember being a little bit high because it was a really nervous situation for me to walk into his room. He came by himself on this one trip. And I got into his room. He sat me down. He's just the most special man in the world. He sat me down. Come on, boy, sit down. How did it all work out? You're okay. You got through it. He goes, how you doing financially? I'm like, it's rough. And I kind of started crying a little bit. And he goes, look, man, you're going to make lemonade out of lemons. I guarantee you, you're going to look back at this time in your life and you're going to say, if that never happened, these other doors wouldn't have opened, because God tests great men and women, and he's testing you right now, just like he tested me. And I'm like literally sitting here like this. And I was like, well, Irvin, I call him by his real name. I said, Irvin, I got an idea. He goes, what is it? I said, a business idea. He goes, okay, you know, let me hear it. What's your next move? And I said, I want to be an agent. So, man, you need some big clients to do that. He goes, you have any idea who you're looking to have as your first client? And I still get choked up telling the story because, you know, you hear about these moments in life. I listen to guys like you and Lewis Howes and Jay Shetty and Gary Vee, and you have these moments in your life that if you don't go for it, you could regret it forever. And it came out, and I said, I would love to have you as my first client if that's possible. And because do you have a good entertainment lawyer? I said, no, I don't. He goes, well, you better find one and send a contract to the office next week. And he looks at me and goes, I'm going to give you 2 years to represent me. But if you don't use me and knock down every door to bring in all the biggest celebrities you can, I'm going to fire you. Because isn't that how successful I become, Darren? I'm going to be successful. It's how successful I make you and everybody else around me.
Wow.
Because life is about what you can do for other people. I left the room like thinking, did he just tell me that I should be exploiting him to build
my company,
my agency? And it's exactly what he did. I mean, you know, within 6 months, I had Chevy Chase, Pamela Anderson, Dennis Rodman. I met a year later. Smoking Joe Frazier was actually the second right after Magic. A couple years after that, Magic was in Hawaii with Dave Winfield. I got a lead for a slot machine licensing deal for Evo Knievel.
You're the one that makes all the weird slot machine, all those weird branded things.
So I get Evo on the phone with Magic, and Magic tells him all these great things about me, and Evo Knievel's now a client. And I didn't understand that back then, but now I do, because when I look at all these outlets that we have now, we're so dialed in at such a high level to the ad agencies and the corporations. It all helps everybody. It's all one big family. So I now look at what Magic said and meant, and it was true. It was spot on.
What did you learn from having to call all your celebrity friends and other car dealer or memorabilia dealers and have to just come clean about this whole FBI thing? Because that could have destroyed you, but it didn't.
Yeah, it killed me. But it was also, in a way, I'll tell you, when I was so broke, I remember telling myself that I'm never going to forget this feeling, because thank God I had the perspective enough to look at it differently and say, I don't have kids right now. I'm a single guy. I do think I can rebuild. I do believe I'm going to turn this around. I was on Dave Meltzer's podcast about this conversation because he's made and lost it. And I said, Dave, I just knew. I had this feeling inside of me that my time is going to come again. And it was a wake-up call to watch my spending, be more careful about just throwing money out there the way that I was throwing it. And yeah, little by little, within a couple of years, it started to happen.
Yeah, it just seems like it would be, you really could have turned the corner in a bad way and been like, reputation shot, you're still using at this point.
Of course.
So that could have been you flushing it down the toilet at that point.
Yep.
Jeez, man. Even later on, I mean, this imposter syndrome, do you think you're over it now? Or do you just manage it differently?
No, I think I'm over it now.
Really?
I truly do.
Yeah?
I truly do. I don't know if I could have told you that 4 or 5 years into my sobriety. But man, you put me in front of a football field with 100,000 people at Wembley right now. I'll speak to them like I'm speaking to you. And love every minute of it and be so comfortable talking about the uncomfortable. Knowing that not as much that I needed God, but God needed Darren Prince at a certain point. That my journey was all about being a recovery advocate and getting this message out there. I don't care what end of the world you're from, that you can turn your darkest days into the brightest of lights, because I'm living proof.
I think it is great that you, of course, eventually made it to sober, because there's an anecdote in the book where Dennis Rodman and you are partying for a long, long, long time. I mean, months and months or years and years, whatever it is. And then one day he wakes you up and says, hey, man, you're going to miss your flight.
Yeah.
When Dennis Rodman wakes you up because you're going to miss your flight, did you kind of get on that plane and go, hang on a second, if Dennis Rodman is the responsible adult in our relationship, what's happening?
We did an interview with Fox last week for his ESPN 30 for 30, and I told that story. I was still a little bit like buzzed when he woke me up. But the amazing thing was, is after Celebrity Big Brother in England, so he got evicted from the house and we hit a strip club that night. We went to a bar called Pangea. He woke me up, barely made it on the flight. We're on the plane and we're on the right side in business class. And he looks over. I was like, bro, is that Muhammad? I'm like, what's he talking about? I look to my left. Muhammad, Alani, Ali are two rows to the left of us on the same flight. So we got up and said hello to him, gave him a big hug. And I was like, go figure. But no, I don't really think it meant that much. And I think we were laughing about it because I was still at that point where it was somewhat working. I realized it obviously a few years later that there's something really wrong with Dennis Rodman waking up his agent so they make the flight.
I mean, looking back then, were you looking at him and going, wow, he's out of control, but I'm fine?
That's exactly what it was. And I'd be on the plane, like, swallowing pills and having a Bloody Mary or so. And, you know, he'd be drinking. I'm like, dude, you got to slow down with the freaking drinking, man. You're out of freaking control. I'd yell, we fight with each other. And don't tell me, you and your freaking pills, Darren. You know, it was like two brothers.
They're from a doctor.
Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Dude, I would hold the bottle. Dr. So-and-so gave him to me. Don't start with me. I got sciatica.
Yeah. Like, how's your sciatica? Yeah. You've had 17 Vicodin. It's 9 a.m. How did you end up sending Dennis and you, by the way, going with him to North Korea? Like, what happens when you get that request and you're like, this seems like a good idea? Take me through this thought process here.
So I got a call from Shane Smith and somebody from his office. I forget the guy's name, from Vice Media. And they tell us about this idea to bring Dennis with the Harlem Globetrotters. He'd be a producer on the special, an on-air talent. Well, not a lot of money, but something historic for him to be a part of. And I was like, all right, no, I'll bring it to him. It sounded unique. And the trip got canceled 3 different times, Jordan. Like, we had contracts signed, dates. They started working on flights. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why that kept happening. This is crazy. They gave us a deposit. They booked the flights. And they're changing it again.
Like, get your shit together.
We kept putting it on Dennis's schedule. Like, guys, we're missing opportunities. Enough is enough. Finally, it gets done. And they call me and tell me that they got the clearance that they needed. It's like, all right, I just figured they needed clearance to film. I didn't know there was other clearance involved. At the time, Psy was the biggest thing in the world to rap.
Gangnam Style, right?
So, yeah. So I go downstairs to Steve Simon, who's the VP of my agency.
Good old buddy.
The baseball card show with me. Steve is the book smart guy. And I go downstairs with the contract, so excited. Go, bro, finally, I got the deal done with Dennis to go to Korea. We got to figure out who Psy's manager is so he can see Psy. And he goes, cool, dude. When's he leaving? Let me see the contract. And I go, he's going to North Korea on, he goes, you mean South? I go, no, North. He's like, bro, are you an idiot? He goes, you can't send him to North Korea. And I said, what are you talking about? This is going to be historic. He looks at it, starts pulling everything up on North Korea on the internet. He goes, come here, you moron. Look at this. They start showing me all these stories.
Yeah, the most isolated country in the world.
Crazy. I'm like, let me call Dennis. And I called him up. And to his credit, man, he was sitting right here. He's like, dude, I don't give a damn. Just make sure I'm safe. Because if nobody's met this leader, this ruler, I guarantee I'm going to meet this motherfucker. And I might be able to open up some doors with him and President Obama and create some seriously historical shit.
And he exactly literally said that on the phone.
Exactly what Dennis said to me. And I go, man, that's pretty cool. And, you know, we sent him and they called me at like 11 o'clock that night when he was already in Beijing. As you know, you have to take that Beijing flight into the airport in Pyongyang. And they said, get ready for your client's biggest press hit of his life. And I go, well, guys, it's not going to be bigger than the wedding dress. I mean, please. They're like, this is going to dwarf the wedding dress.
This is international news.
Yeah, it's international. There's social media now. There wasn't social media back then. When I tell you, when I woke up at 5 in the morning to go to the bathroom, I've never seen more text messages, more emails, more media outlets around the world. It was like nothing I've ever seen, because at that point, he already went to the game. And he was already had that iconic moment sitting next to Kim Jong-un like this.
Right.
And it was everywhere. Breaking news. And I couldn't believe it.
I think Vice's value tripled after that week, at least.
Oh, we have a wonderful pistachio commercial. Oprah did an interview with him. He was the first basketball player ever over 50 years old, or I think athlete in general, to open Saturday Night Live with Live from New York Saturday night. He got a Foot Locker commercial. And we didn't do it for that. We didn't expect
of course,
any of this.
Yeah. Did you think at any point, okay, from all I read on Wikipedia, thanks to my buddy, he might never come back from North Korea?
I did for a minute, but when he made it back that first trip, then I kind of felt a lot more comfortable. I figured, you know, this is pretty cool. Dennis said they want him to come back in a few more months.
If he wanted to keep him, he would have kept him. Yeah, right?
Exactly.
Oh, man. You've lived a hell of a life so far. So what's next for you?
What's next for me, man? I mean, I'm just happy. You know, like we talk about, to be able to find my real self, man. And be out there. The business is going to take care of itself. I'm always going to be a hustler. My clients know that about me. But it's about the recovery, just getting my message out there around America, around the world, to show kids, adults, whoever it might be, that hope and recovery exist. And no matter what you're going through, there's nothing that makes me happier than getting in front of a live audience and knowing that the lights come on in somebody's eyes and I find one person in that crowd whose life gets changed. Because I've been given a gift. Sobriety and recovery is a gift. And I got to work hard at every single day, going to my meetings and giving back. I had a random message on Instagram this morning, 7 o'clock this morning. A guy in New York, hey man, can you call me? I'm struggling. I'm very inspired by your post. Drop everything. I put up conference calls. That's how I build self-esteem, by doing esteemable acts. That's how I could tell you that there is no more imposter syndrome, because I know the real Darren Prince. I finally arrived to a spot where most people never get to in their lifetime. And what a feeling that it's a 49 years old when I look how I was at 29 years old and 19 years old. And you're never too old to make that change. This is the greatest thing I've done for myself in a long span of time. And you know, the agent life, that's good and great, man. That's bullshit. That's not why I was put on this earth. This right here, and like I said, everything I do with getting this message out there, this is my calling. I found myself.
Thank you very much, man.
Thanks for having me.
Big thank you to Darren Prince. His book is called Aiming High, How a Prominent Sports and Celebrity Agent Hit Bottom. He is just a cool guy. I like him. We're friends now. He helped me hook up Dennis Rodman as well, which I really appreciate. I mean, he's just a good person. I'm so glad to meet good people who are at the top of the industry like this, because it reaffirms all the things that we're doing here. Because you do see a lot of, I mean, you watch the news. Sometimes there's a lot of scumbags at the top. Darren's at the top, and he got there because he's an awesome guy who does what he says he's going to do. So I really appreciate about him. Links to his stuff and his book will be in the show notes. There's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. We filmed this at the Mondrian Hotel in Los Angeles. Special thanks to them for hooking up that room. I really appreciate it. The Mondrian Hotel there on Sunset Boulevard, right in the heart of it all. There's also worksheets for each episode, so you can review what you've learned here from Darren Prince at jordanharbinger.com in the show notes. And I'm teaching you how to connect with great people and manage relationships using systems and tiny habits, so you can get your own Darren Prince tactics going. That's our 6-minute networking course, which is free over at jordanharbinger.com/course. I know, you'll do it later, right? Yeah, you'll do it later. No, dig the well before you get thirsty. You've got to help people before you ask them for stuff. Once you need relationships, you're too late. Don't procrastinate. That'll make you stagnate. Especially when it comes to your personal and business relationships. The drills, they take a few minutes per day, hence the name 6-minute networking. Jeez, I mean, I would have chosen 4-minute networking, but nobody would believe me, right? I wish I knew this stuff 20 years ago. It's not fluff, it's crucial. Find it all for free, jordanharbinger.com/course. And by the way, most of the guests on the show, they subscribe to the course and the newsletter, so come join us and you'll be in some smart company. Speaking of building relationships, you can always reach out and follow us on social, or just reach out and talk to us there. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. This show is created in association with Podcast One. This episode was produced by Jen Harbinger, Jason DeFilippo, edited by Jace Sanderson, show notes and worksheets by Robert Fogarty, music by Evan Viola, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Our advice and opinions and those of our guests are their own, and yeah, I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer, so do your own research before you implement anything you hear on this show. And remember, we rise by lifting others. The fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful or interesting, which should be in every episode. So please, share the show with those you love, and even those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.